Hi, everybody, and welcome to Phillies Backstage. I'm Tom Burgoyne, joined by John Brazier. And, John, we have another classic player from the 1993 National League Championship champion Phillies.
Well, it's one of our favorite players on the field, certainly around the 93-94 that era, but also off the field, we get a chance to see him. I get a chance to see him at fantasy camp every year, and I know he's part of the Darren Dalton Foundation. He comes up every year for the great golf event. So very proud to bring on Jim Eisenreich. Izzy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Then Tom said classic. Does that mean old?
Well, we're right there with you, Jim.
Yeah, we're right there with you. Yeah, we've been fortunate enough, Jim, to, you know, interview a lot of guys from the team, and we love talking about those days. It was great seeing you. Yeah, we saw you last month. Darren Dalton Foundation had a great weekend, the celebrity golf event, as well as the celebrity bartending event. But great that you could come up and be a part of that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And we'd love to, you know, talk a little bit about, certainly we're going to talk about the 93 Phillies, but we'd love to kind of talk about your career, fascinating career, Jim. You grew up in Minnesota, and just kind of reading your background, everywhere you went, Jim, you hit. When you were, 8 years old and playing Little League or wasn't in T-ball back then, could you always hit?
Well, pretty much, I think so. To not brag, I hit the ball. I made a lot of contact. I was able to, I guess, adjust to each new level and wanted to, probably more than anything. And so I did. I could hit a little bit.
Now, also, we've talked, and being from Minnesota, I know the answer, but you were a hockey player as well. Did you start hockey at a young age as well?
Yes. Yeah, sad to say, but I almost liked hockey more than baseball. It was more popular in Minnesota, and hockey was fun. We had a rink in our backyard. My dad made every winter. It was cool as could be.
And you're one of five kids, so you could field a whole team, right? Well, you need a goalie. I guess your dad would have to be goalie.
Well, kind of, but my older two brothers weren't real keen on skating for whatever reason. And my sister, we didn't always let her play because her friends were with her. And they couldn't skate. Now, she could.
Right.
We were kind of mean that way.
Do you consider yourself a good skater? Like, were you a good skater? And can you still
very
skate
good
pretty
ice
good?
Hockey player, yeah. Tom. Believe me.
Yeah.
That's what I could. I could skate. I was a playmaker type. And you know, John, what you played. And, but I could skate. I was fast, aware of the game. You know, I didn't have all the moves. Like, it seems like a lot of the guys do now. And practice, but I like to say I was like a Gretzky type where I could read the rink and know where my guys were.
Well, you know what's interesting? So I used to play in the morning hockey over at the Wells Fargo Center before Flyers games. They laid the ice down, and I brought Matt Stairs out there one time. Matt was a very good player. Obviously he coached up in Maine, but you know, Matt grew up playing ice hockey and was a super, super hockey player.
So yep, he's told me that too.
I guess we can't talk about your history, Jim, without talking about your Tourette syndrome, I guess about what age did you feel like you had the symptoms of, I guess at that time you didn't know what you had, right?
That's
it wasn't
correct.
Diagnosed.
So it was probably first or second grade. But didn't, I just knew that I was doing these things. I didn't like them. But nobody really knew why. I went to a Catholic grade school. So I had some nuns for teachers, and that didn't always work out so well. it was around then, and my parents did what they could to try to figure it out. And, doctors tried to figure it out, but they said, well, Jim has these habits and, if it's not affecting his school or whatever else he does, then he'll probably grow out of them.
And Tourette syndrome is either or both verbal tics, right, or physical tics.
Correct. And
so how did it manifest itself with you at that time?
First, to get a real diagnosis, you do have to have both, the motor and the vocal. So the first ones that I had – where the motor, like I blinked my eyes. And that's kind of the very typical, I guess, starting point, you know, and I could always see well, but I'd get asked if I could, if I was having trouble seeing, you know, and I'd blink my eyes. It just seemed like nonstop. And those kind of evolved into something, moving my neck and shoulders. And, but the vocal part of it was probably the worst, because I would, oh, I'd sniffle and kind of grunt like I was clearing my throat and like I had a cold. And in fact, my dad's buddies would always ask, you know, take care of that cold when you get home. Or, you know, it's like, well, Dad didn't know I had one. But anyway, so that's what I really did at the start. And typically they go away after a while, but then they're replaced by something else, you know. So
that's
how it was for me.
Yeah, and I guess playing sports was great for you. Maybe if your mind's not on it, did you feel pretty comfortable playing sports?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it was a distraction from having any kind of problem. And even though we didn't know it was called Tourette, you know, I knew that I was different than my fam, my brother, sister, and, you know, classmates, and even my teammates on the different sports. But it was a really good distraction for me. And so even though I did them, you know, I could still play, because you're always moving.
Yeah.
And that helped kind of mask them.
Yeah, and then you went to St. Cloud Technical High School, and then, which is great, then St. Cloud State University, and again, you recruited, you played in college,
which is one of the top ice hockey programs in the country.
Well, they must have baseball too, because Jim did okay there. But what I thought was interesting is that your dad went there as well. Did he play baseball there at St. Cloud?
Well, you know what, my dad, he did not play baseball there. No, he was a World War II guy. It was kind of funny. He went to high school at the Catholic school in St. Cloud, St. Cloud Cathedral. But he went to college at St. Cloud State, but he didn't really get his degree until he got back from World War II. And so he never played. He actually played hockey more than anything. And he played slow pitch softball, and, you know, that was what they did. But he did not play college baseball.
Yeah, you must have been excited that you're going to St. Cloud State and following his footsteps a little bit there. And I guess you did okay. In college, Jim, was Tourette's, I guess, were you battling it then too? Or did it get in the way of your career there in college playing baseball?
You know, it only got in the way of some of the school classes. But, you know, once you get to college, you kind of have mobility, because you don't just have a class, you know, every hour of every day. You know, you make your own schedule and you go to a, you know, a lecture or a lab or, you know, whatever it is. And typically, like it was for me when I was younger, there were no seating charts. So I could sit in the back. I was a little more comfortable then. But there were times when I was advised to go to the nurse's station or whatever they called it. And because someone must have said something that he's making all this noise and doing these things. And so I'd go, and the nurse would tell me that, so how long have you had these tremors? He called them tremors. Well, I don't know. I've done these forever. I don't know. Okay. You know, so nothing ever really came of that as far as medically speaking, and it didn't really affect my playing ball. Again, that was a really good distraction for me. I loved working out, practicing. Of course, we're all inside, you know, in the winter up there. And then just to play was a lot of fun.
Well, speaking of inside, so did they diagnose it as agoraphobia, which is the fear of being outside or being in large crowds? Was that what they were?
I think over the years I was diagnosed with every phobia possible.
Right.
So agoraphobia, claustrophobia, stage fright. Let's see what else. There's a whole bunch of things.
And were they constantly like, were trying different medications with you for these different ailments that they're diagnosing? Like, how did that work?
Well, I didn't get any of that kind of medical help until I got to the Twins.
Okay.
And that was when I was really having trouble on the field.
Right.
Up until then, I never had trouble on the field. You know, I just did these things, and my teammates would, what do you do that for? You know, I don't know. I didn't know how to answer them. And so I didn't get the medicine help, and really till I got to the big leagues with the Twins in 82.
Yeah, in 82, you make it. And then I guess center field, too. You started center field for that. Were you always an outfielder, too, Jim?
Yeah, I, you know, okay. Being left-handed, I could run. So that, yeah. And you know, with the Twins in those days, I don't know if you remember, but their owner, that was his business. He didn't have a side business, and baseball was his hobby.
Yeah, like, it's Calvin Griffith,
like,
right?
A lot of them.
Yep.
Calvin Griffith, that's correct. And I was in the right place at the right time a lot then. And we ended up having, I think, 15 rookies in the course of 82 and 83, wow. You know, late 81. You know, Kent Herbert, Gary Gaetti,
Ron
Frank
Washington.
Viola.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yep, all these guys.
And that was the first year of the Metrodome, Jim?
That's correct. I was, yeah. And that, you know, is a dream come true for me.
Yeah,
starting
center
fielder,
team.
Lead up hitter. Oh. I'm live an hour north there, you know, and yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. Well, then let's go to, and you know, I can't wait to get into the 93 season, but then, like, I guess you had an incident in Fenway where it kind of all came to a halt, where you went off the field. You know, and then I guess later that season you had another incident. So, you know, that's where it's really – I just find it amazing that the doctors at that point couldn't diagnose a Tourette syndrome, because it really wasn't until you were about 23 when they officially diagnosed it as Tourette's, correct?
Right. And that is mainly because there's such a fine line between that and, you know, behavior issues.
Right.
You know, trying to get attention or whatever. And there's no physical test for having Tourette. It's really done by observation. And they, you know, they, of course, when I got to the Twins, they didn't know any of my history. They didn't know what I was like as a kid. There was nothing to go on other than what maybe my parents said or what I told them. And so it was just, it was often misdiagnosed in those days,
right.
Very often.
Huh. So. Well, then you go back and forth, and then, which I, again, your story is, it's a movie. There's a movie made. I can't believe a movie hasn't been made. Because then you basically kind of go back and forth between being on the team and then you know, quitting or not quitting, but, you know, stopping baseball.
Voluntarily retiring.
Voluntarily retiring, yes. And then you basically spent 3 years. Yeah. You retired, basically. You spent 3 years in St. Cloud working as a part-time painter. You worked in an archery shop, played semi-pro, I guess was it baseball or softball. Which is crazy. Like, what, you know, you don't hear that, somebody taking 3 years off, especially after what happened to you afterwards, because we all know it from being a Phillies fan. But that's, tell us about taking those 3 years off and then, you know, and then basically willing yourself to try it one more time.
Well, I think you've probably heard me say before, one of my childhood dreams or goals was to be normal.
Yeah.
You know, whatever that was supposed to mean, but in my mind, it meant that I wouldn't have any tics or whatever, you know, the Tourette part of it. And so that was normal to me. And I just, the 3 years out, I guess when I first had the issues in Boston and then eventually got to a hospital in Minneapolis, I kind of felt for the first time I was getting the medical help I probably needed. And I say that because this is a Major League Baseball team. They had access to every known medical thing, I thought, you know, going on. And so in some ways I felt a little relief, but I also, I was still hopeful, and I guess cautiously hopeful maybe is a better way to say it. And so when I heard the word, or the phrase Tourette syndrome, you know, I didn't really understand it. And it probably took me the better part of a year or two to research and read what I could about it. It's like, wow, this is kind of exactly what I do. So what it did for me, though, is it gave a reason for what I was doing, but it also did give me hope, because the thing I thought was, I'm not the only one that has this, and there is help. And that, those were the two big things. And it all went back to wanting to be a normal person, you know?
Yeah.
And so...
Well, and
that's how it happened.
Yeah, and you went to the Royals, and what I thought was interesting too, Jim, is your manager at the Twins was Billy Gardner, and here they had just hired, the Royals had just hired Billy Gardner. He was your manager for a number of years. Was he pretty supportive of what you were going through at that time?
You know, yeah, and it was another, it was a weird situation there, because he wasn't supposed to be the manager. He was going to be the third base coach. Dick Houser, you know, was the manager of the Royals, and he was diagnosed with cancer, and he, I saw him one day in spring training, and that was it. And then they named Billy as the interim manager. And so there he was again, you know, and, he was supportive from the standpoint that I knew, talking to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. In some ways, I always felt really guilty and responsible for the twins not doing as well and having worried about me being, you know, in and out of the lineup, because that was not the way you like it to be. And we had a lot of young guys, and I think some of them weren't real happy with me either, you know, and I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was kind of helpless. So anyway, that was that. Once I got called, I went to AA. I think you knew that, but I went to AA with the Royals out of spring training, and I was called up in mid-June, and there's Billy. You know, he's now the manager. He's been the manager, and he seemed okay with everything.
Yeah.
You know?
So. Yeah. Yeah, well, and then, you know, you actually had some good years in Kansas City, and then I guess it finally happened. A free agent, 93, the Phillies finished in last place in 92. Did you know much about the club before you signed here, Jim?
No, I knew nothing.
Right.
No, being the in the situation I was in, I only had two offers from teams as a free agent, and the other team was the Braves.
Could you imagine,
the Braves,
John?
We
wouldn't be talking to him right now.
The Braves wanted to send me to AAA, you know, a minor league contract, and even though I was 34, it's like, okay, I want to go play where the big boys play. Yeah.
So what did Lee Thomas, was the platoon situation, you wound up in a platoon situation in right field with Wes Chamberlain. And of course we had Inky and Milt out in left field.
Who were also new that year.
New that year. And you had Mickey and Mariano at second. But was that, what did Lee explain maybe what your role was going to be with that team?
Not really. No, mm-hmm. I think that was all going to be Jimmy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I didn't really care. I was on the team. I was going to take whatever. I was third, fourth. You know, I was an old guy. So I was going to do whatever I could and just be a good teammate. And
yeah.
It turned out way better than I thought.
Well, yeah. And so you come, and it's been talked about a lot, Jim. You come, it's spring training. You're in Clearwater. You're in the locker room. It is this group that Lee put together. You know, we had a number of free agents, a lot of new faces that year, but it was a veteran team. And it was kind of do or die. I mean, a lot of guys who were, you know, getting up there in years and
a motley crew
yeah. You know, so it's been kind of, you know, talked about how they made you feel welcomed in kind of a roundabout way. How did you feel in that clubhouse that spring training?
Well, that was kind of it, you know. Crucky's he's a crack up. I mean, he's crazy, you know, in a really good way. But it was almost like from day one, you know, in spring training, and it just, everybody kind of make jokes, you know. We had a really good spring, you know. I don't know if you remember, but we won a bunch of games, and I don't know, after the 10th game, I think we're coming into the clubhouse and Larry Anderson says, just another lousy one run win, you know, and you know that, but that's the way they were. It just kind of lighthearted, but. You know, it's spring training, so you really don't care or really don't know what the season's going to be like. But, you know, it carried right down into the season. And the funny thing was, somewhere in the middle of the season, Crucky was we were just chatting a little bit, and he said, you know, with you on this team, with all these crazy guys, you must feel like you're the most normal person around.
Right.
It's like, Johnny, you just gave me my childhood dream.
Right,
I was a normal guy.
Well, and I love what you said to Kruk. Well, I guess one time he was on a bus, and he said, "Hey, Dahmer." He called you Jeffrey Dahmer. He goes, "Hey, Dahmer," and then tell what your response was.
Oh, this was it wasn't Krucky, actually.
Oh.
It was Ink Avilia.
I was Ink.
I can tell you the story if you want. It's kind of funny. It was a spring training road trip. We didn't, you know, you don't usually have road trips. We went over to Vero Beach and wherever else over there. And Inky was my roommate. And we played the first game and went to the room that night. Well, Inky wasn't there. And I was there all night. We get up in the morning, play the game, hop on the bus, and Inky's in the back of the bus. And you know the story about how Crucky used Jeffrey Dahmer on me.
Yeah.
And if people don't know who he is, they can Google him.
Yeah, we don't need to explain so, it on the podcast, right?
No. Inky hollers at me. He says, "Hey, Rumi, thanks for not eating me last night." And I said, "You're welcome, lunch." And it's like, it was funny.
Oh, it brings the house down. And didn't you have a bow and arrow, too?
Well, that's where it started.
Yeah.
One of my passions is I'm a hunter, and I've shot archery. You know, you mentioned earlier that I used to work in an archery shop, and that was my passion. I did a lot of that, and I had a magazine in spring training, and I'm looking through the magazine, and that's what they had on the page. It was the arrow tips, which are called broadheads. You know, they're razor blades. And Crucky sees that, and he says, "Look at that. What are you going to do with that? Are you looking for a victim?" You know, and so that's where you look. You're kind of like Jeffrey Dahmer, aren't you? You know, that's where that all started.
And then
so.
I think he says, I think Dalton was walking by, and you might have mentioned, "Yeah, that's a good target. There's a lot of meat on that one." You know, that's all good.
Well, but it also must have been cool going back to baseball. Is that now you played all your career so far in the American League, and now you're coming over to the National League? How did you like the National League with your style of play?
I loved it. You know, in the American League, if I wasn't starting, which was pretty normal, I was always a kind of a backup outfielder, spot starter, at least with the Royals. And so you kind of go to sleep, you know, unless someone gets hurt really early in the game. You just don't do anything until late in the game. And then you might pinch hit for like the catcher, if you got a catcher that can't hit, or anyway, so you're not really there all the time, it seems like, mentally. In the National League, you almost got to be ready all the time, you know, at least by the third inning. Because, yeah, you know, when things happen, pitchers having a rough day, you got to pinch hit, you know, and so I love the game. I just, you know, and, you know, Larry Boa being our third base coach, and you know how he just yips and yips, and smartest coach I ever knew. I love the guy, you know, and everybody complains about him hollering all the time, but he was aware of everything. He kind of coached the way I like to play, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Always ready. You know, you're always ready for the next thing to happen and just be prepared for it. And that's kind of how the National League to me was. And it was great. I loved it.
Well, that team in particular too, Jim, I mean, just having those platoons just seemed like everybody on that team contributed. And to Todd Pratt behind the plate, you know, spelling Dutch
Ricky Jordan at first base.
Yeah, Jordan at first. You know, you had your platoons in those three positions. It seemed like every player and the bullpen, everybody on that bullpen, that
Kim
starting
Batiste.
Staff was, you know, Ben Rivera had a great year. David West, you know, it just seemed like every player on that team produced. And you know, as you know, Jim, you know, I wrote a book about that team with a friend of mine years ago, and we asked every player what was it like, and every player, everybody said it was the most fun they ever had playing baseball, and it was like Christmas morning, every, you know, coming to the ballpark. So I gotta think, mm-hmm, just the looseness of that team and the fun, and maybe they weren't playing every day, you know, you might, you know, want to play that day, and you're going to sit because it's the day off that you have, but still it was, you know, a lot of fun. I guess that had to play into the success of the team.
Oh, absolutely. And there was not anybody that was made to feel not part of the team. We didn't have anybody moping around. You know, you just didn't do it. And the way Jimmy managed to it, he'd like to have everybody play. You know, he's sort of traditional, but, you know, he didn't really like to have your set nine guys. He said it takes everybody. And as the years have gone on, I've realized, well, that's so true. I wonder if guys in the old days could do better at that, could have done better, you know, by utilizing the whole, well, 25-man roster, whatever, I don't know what it is now, is extra guys, but, you know, everyone on our team was made to feel like they were the best thing going and knew their role and accepted it, and it was a good thing. And, you know, I would definitely agree that it helped add to our success.
Well, and then we beat Atlanta Braves in the NLCS that year. Everyone remembers, you know, you can still picture Mitch jumping up in the air and everyone flying out of the dugout and people going nuts. And then you go to the World Series, and I think every Phillies fan will always remember game two of the World Series when you had your three-run home run, which brought the house down. Brought Philly,
in Toronto.
I mean,
yeah,
Toronto.
Yeah.
Brought everyone,
our section.
Everyone in Philadelphia, right, at their home, brought their house down. Yeah. Maybe not in Toronto.
In Toronto, is we had the a charter gym, you know, the front office employees. And so we had a couple sections at the Toronto Dome. And, oh, my gosh, that home run, I'll never forget it. You know, we went nuts because we needed to win that game. We had lost game one, right, Jim? And then game two, we needed that to come back split.
The 0-2 to Eisenreich. Fly ball to right. Well hit. Carter sprinting back. It's over his head and over the fence. A three-run homer for Jim Eisenreich. And the Phillies lead 5-0.
That was pretty fun. I watch it every occasionally now.
You're also in the same hometown as, I believe, Joe Carter also lives in Kansas City. So do you ever run into Joe Carter?
Yeah, unfortunately, all the time.
You know
what's bad is he's a good guy.
I know. I was going to say the same thing. And we all want to hate him, but I've gotten to know him a little bit too, and it's like he is such a good guy, but we'll never forgive him.
Yeah. I know. I give him a hard time because we'll be doing an autograph thing, and everybody comes up to him, "Hey, Mr. Carter, can you sign this World Series ending home run, you know, walk-off, blah, blah, blah." And after about the 10th person that does that, said, "Joe, are you paying these guys to do this? Because they have no clue that I was on the other team."
Well, and then to add to your you know, Cinderella career, which is great, and I mean that obviously in a very positive way, you go to the Florida Marlins once again. You know what? You're pretty good. When you sign as a free agent with somebody, you the team goes to the World Series the next year, right? So here you sign with the Marlins in 1990, I guess in December 96.
Seven.
97 correct. Season. And it's in, we've heard from, you know, Darren had told me this story where, you know, I guess they needed leadership. They had Bonilla and they had, you know, Moise Alou. They had Jeff Conine, Sheffield. But they needed someone. Mm-hmm. They were kind of more individuals, and they needed more of a leader, someone to kind of take over. And that's when they got Dutch, and obviously they had you. Talk about, and you had obviously a huge home run in game three. So, talk about that team and talking about being reunited with Dutch.
Well, he was right. Obviously, it was a team of some pretty good players, you know, that had a lot of success. And we of course were second fiddle to the Braves, you know, which was kind of standard apparently, you know, they were in the midst of their winning. So anyway, we're going along and this is going to be the first year of the wild card, I believe. We had interleague play. I'm trying to think of this through.
Interleague play started at 97.
Yeah. I think the wild card started
so that
in 97,
event, that,
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and so we needed to have a wild card to be able to get in because we ended up played the Giants right away, and then the Braves played whoever else the other division winner was, I forget, and then we played the Braves for the national championship. So anyway, we're going along, and the Braves are ahead of us by, I don't know, 6-7 games, it seemed like. And we get to the July trading deadline, and we signed Dutch. And so it was – because, you know, Jim Leland was our manager. He asked me, he said, what do you think of we're going to bring Dalton in? Huh. Oh, he's great, tremendous, you know. Yeah. And so he's not going to catch. He's going to, you know, use him as a first baseman and pinch hitter. And, you know, so no, you'll like him. He does everything. And so what was funny was when he joined the team, we were in Cincinnati playing the Reds. And the first game that he was at, we lost the game. It was kind of a bad game, just stupid. You know, we should have won. We gave it up at the end and lost. And so the next day we come back and we did the same thing again. We lost the game. It was just played really bad for the guys. And after the game was over, if you remember the old Cincinnati's Riverfront Stadium, the dugout there, there was a long tunnel from the dugout up to the clubhouse, a really long one. So right after the game, Dutchie has all the players stay right there at the dugout tunnel entrance. All the bat boys, coaches, manager, everybody else get out, you know. And so what he said to us, he said, I've only been here two bleeping days, and yet it's like it's a country club. You don't even care, you know. Think you got to do something a little different. And that's all he said, you know. And we all go up. We come back the next day and play our third game there, probably getaway day, and Darren's the first baseman. And his first at bat, he hit like a broken bat, like a humpback liner over the first baseman's head. And, you know, Darren's knees were all bad with all the surgeries. And he just busted his tail and got a double. Mm-hmm. And I think right there, you know, you had Sheffield and Bonilla and all these guys. Okay, so what he told us last night, he meant it. And that's from then on, the end of July, we were lights out. We played the Braves in a home and home in a both four game series. We won 3 out of 4 in both. We played the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Orioles. I think we're okay then too. But we either swept or we won 3 out of 4, 2 out of 3. We had a really good about 3 weeks, first part of August, and allowed us to get, you know, in through September and make the playoffs. So yeah. Yeah, it was cool.
The Dutch effect. You got to love it.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Jim, when you look back, I know it's probably not fair to say what team do you identify with the most, because we want to say you're a Philly, you know, but what's it like when you do come back to Philadelphia? I mean, the fans, you're still a fan favorite.
I love it in Philadelphia.
Yeah. I mean, what's it like? Is it a little different when you come to Philadelphia, maybe versus some of the other cities you've played in?
Oh, it's a lot different. Yeah, I look forward to it. I mean, it's they don't even get invited to Florida anymore. You know, they've had 3 ownership changes or whatever, yeah. And they don't even recognize anybody. You know, they fired everybody that was a former player that used to work for them. Anyway, it's kind of weird, but I love I don't have a problem answering it. The Phillies were my favorite team. And every time I coached my kids, I always, and my daughter and my oldest son knew that if any of their teams could have had the same kind of rapport attitude that we had, they would have a lot of fun. Yeah. It's like, I wish every team could experience what we had. So I thoroughly enjoy coming back, you know, and with COVID last year, couldn't go anywhere. I was excited to come to Dutchess, Foundation tournament.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah,
I get excited.
And I got to say, Jim, too, like, you know, all through the years when you were a Philly, you know, I was down in the clubhouse starting in 94, but I know you always took time all the time with other kids and families that were going through some of the afflictions that you went through. And you always had the time to be with those kids, which is great. And you've continued this to this day. You started a foundation, and that's, you know, a lot of your life's work now, post-baseball, is for your foundation. Tell the audience about your foundation.
Well, you're right. When I got to Philly, and we'd started this in Kansas City, the local group had asked me to talk to a couple families, and that evolved into some of the families coming to the games on Sunday. And then when I got to Philly, they allowed me to continue that. But then we started doing it on the road too. You know, when we were on the road, meet teams or meet families and groups. And so, somewhere along the line there, I just decided, you know, I kind of feel obligated to help these kids and their families, because I was lucky. I was blessed that I had a second, third, fourth chance to play, you know, and just, it's craziness. So why wouldn't I at least give them the proper information, you know, where they can go find out what's going on and maybe hope, have them realize that there is hope and these kids are going to be fine. And so started the foundation in 96. Of course, I was still playing. But it's been something that just, you know, tears at my heart when I see families that are struggling. It's like, it shouldn't have to be. And what's happened now, it's been 20 some years later. The second generation or the next generation of families is getting diagnosed. Yeah. And so I get calls and emails. It's like, you know, my daughter worked at a store and had someone come in and, you know, their son was with them and had some tics and lady said something. My daughter just, you know, casually said, so how's your boy doing or whatever she said, you know, and my dad has Tourette, you know, really, you know? And so then she says, here, call him, you know? It's kind of cool. You know, it's very gratifying to me. And, you know, because not about me, but it's about helping the kids. And when you see kids don't even know I played anymore. I'm old and gray. And, but the parents see their kids light up and like parents are now in tears because, wow, right. We didn't know, you know?
Yeah.
So it's cool.
And then how do listeners or fans find out about the foundation?
Well, I have a website and I apologize because it's not always up to date and it's Tourette's.org and I just spell it Tourettes.org. And, you know, probably the easiest thing to do is just Google my name.
Yep.
And somewhere there's going to be information and I eventually get it, you know, and I try to make some calls and send letters. I still get a lot of letters. I got a P.O. box. 953 Blue Springs, Missouri.
Okay.
if they want to know that, it's all there. It's online, you know. Don't have a phone anymore because nobody made a joke about the landline thing.
Yeah,
we don't have those.
I told Jim, I said, we can call you on your landline, your cell. He said, I haven't had a landline in years. Also, Jim, you played for the, as we mentioned, the Royals, the Twins, and the Phillies, and the Marlins, but you never played for the Jets, but your son was a Jet, wasn't he? Wasn't he?
Nice tie.
You like that? You like that tie in there?
I like it.
Your son's a Broadway star, correct?
That's correct.
Huh. And West Side Story, huh?
Yeah. Now, you know, that was one of the only ones that didn't reopen after COVID. And he didn't know why. He kind of, everybody else, all the other theaters in New York kind of had their reopening date around September 1st and they were all notified in the middle of August that they weren't going to reopen West Side Story. I think it's because either director or one of the producers had committed to something else. And I don't know, it was a little bummed, but he's doing other things. So he's doing fine.
Yeah, yeah. So
still
he's
waiting for the next one.
I was going to say, and there'll be a next one. If he was on Broadway, I'm sure there'll be a next one. Yeah.
Well, he was the big deal, and he was a Jet. His name was the big deal.
Nice. Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right, Jim. Well, guess
what? We were lucky.
Yeah, it sounds like it. John has whipped out his quiz, and you are going to be quizzed now on your life, so I hope you're ready for it.
Eight questions, Jim.
Multiple choice.
It's about your life, so you should. And I know you've told me. You told me a couple months ago when I saw you at the Dalton Foundation event that you actually listened to the podcast. So you might have a little hint on there. Which, although I don't think I included anybody from Match Game 76 on this one. So I'm gonna again 8 questions. We always say the bar is about 5. Do we say or 6?
6.
6.
Gotta
is the
get
bar.
Six. Gotta
and
get 6.
Tom, I love asking this question because you're never prepared. What does he win if you get 6 out of 8?
We've been giving out a lot of Fanatic dolls lately, and now we can give an original design Fanatic doll because the original Fanatic's back, which we'll talk about a little later, John.
But all right, there you go.
You're going to get a Fanatic doll, Jim.
Izzy, you're getting a Fanatic doll. All you got to do is get 6 out of 8, and here's your first question. We mentioned that you went to St. Cloud State, a great hockey school in Minnesota. Which of these celebrities did not go to St. Cloud State? So I'm going to mention 4 celebrities. 3 of them went to St. Cloud. 1 did not. Which one did not? So A is Richard Dean Anderson, who people will remember as MacGyver. Jim Varney, who is Ernest P. Worrell. Says, you know what I mean, Vern? Right? Former NHL player Ryan Malone, played for the Penguins, Rangers, and Lightning. Or renowned female wrestler and 4-time TNA Women's Knockout Champion ODB. One dirty, I won't tell you what the B stands for. So is it Richard Dean Anderson, Jim Varney, Ryan Malone, or the wrestler ODB?
I thought you said celebrities went to St. Cloud. It sounds like Jim's the only celebrity. Are they all celebrities?
MacGyver?
MacGyver,
a celebrity.
Okay. All right.
Ryan Malone is a star hockey player.
I'm going to say ODB.
No, I threw you off. Jim Varney never
Jim
went
Varney.
There. I was trying to think of the most random celebrity. Yeah, sorry.
I've never even heard of that guy before.
These ones get hard. Right. It gets easier. Your first professional team was the 1980 Elizabethton Twins, located in Elizabethton, Tennessee. Which one of these guys was not a teammate on that team? Okay, so you have to go back to 1980. Three of these guys were teammates. One was not. Okay, A is Gary Loris. B is Jeff Reed. C is Boyce Orozco. And D is Mingo Nunez. So Gary Loris, Jeff Reed, Boyce Orozco, Mingo Nunez, which was not a teammate.
Gary Loris is not a name I ever heard of.
Yes, Gary Loris is the lead singer of the Jayhawks, who are from Minnesota. So you are correct.
There you go.
Gary Loris is not a teammate of yours. And I love the Jayhawks, and they're from Minnesota, by the way. So check them out. All right, you're one for two. Which of these celebrities did not have Tourette syndrome? Okay, so I'm going to give you four celebrities. Three of them have or had it. One does not. Okay. American singer Billie Eilish. Soccer star David Beckham. C is actor Telly Savalas. And D is Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. So you've got Billie Eilish, David Beckham, Telly Savalas, and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Which one did not or does not have Tourette syndrome?
You know, I it's down to two. Gosh, darn it. I'm going to...
Who's it down to? Because maybe you get a lifeline with Tom Burgoyne.
Well, it's between Billie Eilish and...
Telly
Savalas.
Oh, I might have just given you a clue right there.
Tom, give me...
I don't know. I didn't... Beckham was the...
I know.
Go Kojak. Go Kojak?
Did you say Beckham?
No, you're going Kojak. So, yes, you got it right.
Who's the soccer guy you said?
It's David Beckham.
And he has Tourette syndrome,
yep,
huh?
Yep.
How about that?
Billie Eilish, David Beckham, and Mozart all have it or had it. And Telly Savalas won. So you are two for three. All right. In 1989, you played your first full season as a Major League regular, and you won the KC Royals Player of the Year. You beat out Bo Jackson. How about that? Bo Jackson doesn't get beat out very much in any awards. Which one of your teammates that year was a star baseball player at Penn Charter here in Philadelphia, the same school that Dave Montgomery, Matt Ryan, and Ruben Amaro Jr. all attended? Okay. So do you know the answer already?
I bet, yeah.
A is Willie Wilson, B, Danny Tartable, C, Floyd Bannister, D, Mark Gubizaw.
Gooby, yeah.
Exactly.
Gooby's
right.
Always jealous that I went to the Philly.
Right.
Always jealous.
Awesome.
Three of four, all right, you're on a roll. You were second on the 1993 Phillies team in batting average when you hit .318. And after reading all your stuff, I think you hit .300 in your sleep, right?
I know.
I mean, my gosh.
You woke up.
The stats are unbelievable.
Got hits.
All right. So who was first that year in 1993 with a batting average of .324? Do you need this multiple choice, or you want to? Here's a multiple choice.
Yeah, you better give me.
It's John Kruk, Kevin Stocker, the Dude, or Mariana Duncan.
Jeez.
1993.
So does the number of at bats count?
Well, I did have a qualifier of like over 150, so you couldn't have,
okay.
You know, like Ruben technically, I think, had the highest batting
average.
No,
Larry Anderson batted 1,000.
Oh,
Larry got a hit in Chicago early in the season. He was one for one.
Was he?
Yeah.
And he wondered if he gets another hit, he'll be hit 2,000.
Exactly. Well, he'd always say he's a career 300 hitter because he played in three decades and got a hit in each decade.
Yep. So I think Stock had the
Stock is Stocker. Correct.
You are right.
Yes.
All right. You're on a roll.
So.
4 for 5. All right. You won a World Series with the Florida Marlins, as we mentioned, 1997. Who led that team in home runs that year with 23? Okay. Was it Sheffield, Bonilla, Alou, or Conine? You got Sheffield, Bonilla, Alou, or Conine? 23 home runs.
23 led the club, huh?
Yeah. 1997.
Yeah. Yeah, and I almost don't think it was Sheffield. It should have been, but I don't think it was.
So you got, but so you're gonna eliminate Sheffield, which
Bobby Bull.
No, Moise Alou.
Moise Alou.
Was it Moise Alou?
Yeah. All right, you only have you're basically need to get the next two.
Need to get the next two, Jim. No pressure.
All right, so this one should be easy. Which Toronto pitcher did you hit a 3-run home run off of in the third inning in Game 2 of the World Series? Mike Timlin, Mark Eichhorn, Tony Castillo, or Dave Stewart?
Dave Stewart.
All right, nice. So now I'm going to give you a hockey question for the last question
For the doll.
For the doll, right? big deal right here. You ready? So, obviously, I know you're a big hockey fan. We've talked a lot of hockey. Who has won the most Stanley Cups as a player with 11? He's won 11 Stanley Cups as a player. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, it's a Canadian, because it's almost like guessing that for the Yankees. It's got to be someone, you know, the Canadians are the team that won the most Stanley Cups. So, was it Henri Richard, or otherwise known as Rocket Richard? Was it Yvan Cornoyer? I love saying that last name. Was it Jacques Lemaire? Or is it Bernie Geoffrion? Was it Rocket Richard, Yvan Cornoyer, Jacques Lemaire, or Bernie Geoffrion?
Wow. There's a and they were my favorite team. I almost think you got to go with the Rocket Richard.
Rocket Richard is correct. 6 for 8.
Nice,
you got
done.
It. Wow. You won a Fanatic doll.
The Rocket. Wow. Well, Jim, we really appreciate you joining me and John. We love seeing when you come into town, and really appreciate you jumping on the podcast with us.
And I'm going to see you in January for Fantasy Camp.
Yes, sir. We'll be there.
Looking forward to it.
Awesome.
Yep. Thank you.
All right.
Sounds great.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Have a great holiday, too. All right.
Really appreciate
it. Thank you. You guys, too. All right.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye. You bet. Bye-bye.
There he was, Izzy. John, it's always exciting, huh, when we're talking to any of these guests, but certainly with Izzy, it's great. You know,
it's
such a good guy. One of the good guys. We always say, oh, who's the, one of the good guys, you know, when we put our list together. And, it's always Izzy. He's usually number one.
Well, I talk about my first year in 94, and I mentioned this when Dave Hollins was on. I said there's landmines everywhere, right?
Right.
And he was one of the few safe spaces that Kevin Stocker, Mickey Morandini. I didn't know how nice Tommy was Green back then.
Right.
You know, he was just intimidating because he's so big. But it was literally Stocker, Izzy, and Morandini were the three, my opinion, like the normal. Right? And I didn't know Milt, and I didn't know, like, some of these guys now, you know them as the nicest people in the world.
Right.
But those three were, like, my little safe space that I could ask them a question without, without getting yelled at or, intimidated.
And what a story, right, John? I mean, I know when we were preparing, we were both looking at each other, earlier in the week, like, man, you said it. It really could be
a movie. I can't believe someone hasn't done a movie on this.
He retired for 3 years, came back.
That's in itself crazy.
Yeah. And, he got bullied. I know he said back then he didn't consider it bullying. You know, just thought it was, kids are going to make fun of me. He almost took it in stride. But, the fact is he had a lot of things to go through,
Yeah, and you have to have an inner drive to go through that and to achieve the success he had despite, the affliction that wasn't diagnosed until 23. I mean, that's just truly amazing.
Yeah.
And it's got to say something about someone's character, his heart, his drive, to be able to overcome that pretty much on his own. I mean, the doctors obviously helped, but he really, again, didn't get diagnosed until 23. So amazing story.
Great story. Well, and I said it during the interview, John, the Fanatic, the old Fanatic's back. He never left. That's the thing. He never left.
He just, but now you explained to me that the Fanatic is from the Galapagos Islands.
Correct.
And Charles Darwin, obviously, you always hear about all the animals that have just, it has the most evolved animals, right?
Yeah, some all kinds of different species. And when Darwin went there, he observed them and came up with a lot of his theories of adaptation and survival of the fittest and just evolution in general. And so the Fanatic really is a product of that. And so, a couple of years ago, he was going through some of these changes, and we just thought, well, he's evolving. He's a bird, so he's kind of growing these things under his arm we thought were scales or, feathers, stars around his eyes, not sure of that. And, the bigger butt, we just thought, well, that's kind of
a lot of tasty cakes or something.
Yeah, a lot of tasty cakes. But we thought it was a product of evolution. Well, it turns out
he's done the opposite.
He's going backwards on the evolutionary scale, John. It's
crazy.
Well,
it makes sense because he's 8 years old every year, right? So, he never gets any older, and he's always still as immature as a – 8-year-old, right? So
he's devolving. He's not evolving.
That's really plateauing, really. But he's devolving in this one.
Now he's going backwards. Yeah,
right.
He's
shed the wings.
I think we don't want to completely evolve. Like, you're completely evolved, John. You're a Renaissance man. You're the height of the food chain, But the Fanatic is, a few fries short of a Happy Meal, you know, and that's how we like it.
Like the wheel is spinning, but the hamster's dead?
Correct.
Right.
He's going backwards.
He's going backwards, right.
So it's cool. It was really great to see the fans get so excited on social media. The Phillies posted a couple fun tweets, and it's really cool to see fans are so excited to get the original look back. Yeah.
It's like the original Coke, new Coke, back to original Coke.
Exactly right. We're back to the original.
Right. And you know what I did today, Tom? You're going to be part of this as well down the road. We got an email from a gentleman who is on a cheesesteak quest, right? Yeah. He ate his 962nd cheesesteak today. And about a month ago, he reached out and he wanted me to have a cheesesteak with him. He must listen to our podcast, right? Yeah. So I said, I'm going to be in South Philly on today's date. And he said, all right, we're going to go to, actually, it's his favorite cheesesteak place in the area. So I know we have Tony Luke's here and we have Campos, and you know, but he took me down to Moya Messing. Did I say that right?
Yeah. Moya Messing?
Yeah. I just lost my credibility right there. He took me.
Go back out to the main line.
took me to Charlie's Roast Pork. Which I got to say was really good.
Pretty good. Yeah. I mean, now, how many cheesesteaks has this guy
eaten? That was his 962nd.
900.
So I think he wants to have his 970.
Not one a day. He doesn't eat.
No, not one a day, but he has about four a week. But he said he wants to have his 975th with you.
Does he weigh 975 pounds?
No, he's actually, that's what I was expecting, but he's, he's right.
How about that? Does he exercise? Or?
Sure, he must, right?
Huh.
Yeah, so or he might be a little judicious. I don't know if he eats the whole cheesesteak, right? Yeah. He said he gave, he would eat a cheesesteak and eat half of it and then give the other half to a homeless person or someone that's.
But how do I figure into it? You're saying he's roping me in.
Well, he asked if I could do it, and then I said, you know what? I volunteered yourself. I said,
I can eat a cheesesteak.
Tom Burgoyne.
I'm looking
loves,
at you.
Loves
you
cheese
definitely
steak.
Have
hey.
Eaten a couple cheesesteaks, my friend.
It's a good thing it's not on video. I'm wearing a loose shirt.
It's not that loose.
But yes, you are. All right. In that case, you're gonna be hitting the 970th and 975th. So
I'd be happy to do it. Give me a call, Cheesesteak Man.
There you go.
I'll eat a cheesesteak with
Pappas
you.
Jim Pappas.
Yep. All right. Well, I guess that's a wrap, John. Love having anytime we get a 93 Philly on here. It's great. But I know we got some fun guests coming up, and, it's all good.
Sounds good.
It's all good. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody, to another episode of Philly's Backstage, and we will see you next time.